Hey everyone, welcome to the Latent Space Podcast. This is Alessio, founder of Kernel Labs, and I'm joined by Swix, founder of Small AI.
Hello, hello. Today we're so excited to be in the studio with Gurgun and Batuhan of FAL. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Long time listener, first time caller.
Gurgun, you and I actually go back a long way to when it was still Features and Labels,
yeah.
And you were just coming out of Amazon. I don't even remember the pitch. I honestly should look at my own notes, but you were optimizing runtimes.
Yeah, it was first like we were building a feature store, and then we took a step back, and then we decided to build a Python runtime in the cloud. And that evolved into an inference system that evolved into what FAL is today, which is a generative media platform. So we optimize inference for image and video models and audio models, but we do a lot more. We try to own this whole generative media space for developers, basically.
Yeah, amazing. And we can talk about that, that journey. I wanted to also introduce Batuhan. We're newer to each other, but you've come to some of my meetups before. You're head of engineering.
Yeah, I lead engineering here at FAL, you know. Glad to be here.
Mm-hmm. And what's your journey?
I met Burkay in 2021 when they were just starting a company, and like just before the seed round, you know, Burkay and Görkem, we met online. We're all both Turkish, I think that was a connection. We just met, and then they said, "Oh, why don't you join us?" And like I was one of the core developers of Python language, so I had like really, you know, really good experience with developer tools around the Python language. So I started coming here to build the Python cloud, which evolved into this like inference engine and the generative media cloud that we are building today.
And now you spend less time with Python and more time with, I don't know,
CUDA.
Custom kernels. And
yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember the DBT file when the modern data stack was hot. Can you guys maybe just give a quick sense of the scale of FAL? So you just raised a $125 million Series C.
That's correct.
We can talk about how I passed on one of your early rounds. We can go through that. How many of the developers, how many models do you serve, and maybe any other cool numbers?
Yeah, we have around 2 million developers on the platform. And like we for the longest time, we required GitHub login. It recently changed, but so I'm assuming everyone who has a GitHub account as a developer. We have around 350 models in the platform. These are mostly image, video, and audio models. It used to be only image, and then we added audio, and the space evolved into video as well. And yeah, that's pretty much the scale. We just announced our Series C round, and we've been growing a lot in the past year, and it still continues.
Yeah, you had a very nice Series C party.
Thank you.
And you guys are over $100 million in revenue, right? Just this is not, you know, just developers kind of kicking the tires.
That's correct. Yeah,
that's great. When you say 350 models, I think what percentage of all the models that you could serve is that? Because, you know,
there
especially
is an infinite amount of fine-tuned, post-trained versions of these models. We are trying to serve the models that fix a gap, you know, that fill a gap in the stack. So we don't add a model that's like significantly worse in any aspect compared to other models that we have. We are trying to bring unique models that solve a customer's needs. So that's like, these are 350 models, you know, there's like 20, 30 text image models, but like one of them excels in logo generation, another one excels in human face generation. So like every model has a unique personality, but if a model is like significantly worse in all aspects, we don't add that to the platform. So there's like infinite amount of models that we can add.
And do you rely on your own evals or just like what the community does?
We mainly rely on our own evals as well as, you know, like we are in the community. So we also like follow the community very well to see like what is going to be the thing that's going to be in the next generation of apps. So if we think something, like we have a good intuition, if we think something is going to pop up, we just add it.
Yeah. To my knowledge, you haven't published your own evals, right?
No, we don't.
It's internal. And then the community is Reddit, Twitter?
Twitter, Reddit, you know, Hugging Face, seeing how popular the models are in Hugging Face and other demos.
Okay. I just want to give people a sense of where to get this info.
The best part of the job is the day of a model release, the adrenaline rush that comes with it, the whole team trying to scramble something together and release it. And it happens every week.
Right.
Every week is exciting.
Can we do maybe a brief history of like the models that were like the biggest spikes maybe in usage? Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of, I think everybody knows Stable Diffusion, you know, and then you have maybe like the Flux models, and then you have Black Forest Labs. You had like all these different milestones.
History-wise, I think the biggest, like the initial hit was Stable Diffusion 1.5, which is when we actually pivoted into this new paradigm of FAL, Generative Media Cloud. We started hosting it. We noticed like we had the serverless runtime and everyone was running the Stable Diffusion 1.5 by themselves. And we noticed it's terrible for utilization and they are not optimizing it. So let's just offer an optimized version of this that's ready for API to be scaled. and doesn't require people to deploy Python code, because we want product engineers to start using it. We want mobile engineers to start using it. So we start offering a Stable Diffusion 1.5. It was very popular. The fine tunes around it was very popular. Stable Diffusion 2.1 came. It was a bit of a flop, so it didn't got that much attention. And then SDXL came, which was like the first major model that brought like our first million in revenue, if we consider that. And with SDXL, obviously, like the small fine-tuning ecosystem also like tried exploded. People started fine-tuning their faces, their objects, whatever, and generations with this, like LoRAs, started to become very popular. And then after Stable Diffusion XL, there was like a bit of a quietness around it. You know, ST3, there was like some drama around it. And the team at Stability left to start Black Forest Labs, which released Flux models. And that was the first model to breach the barrier of commercially usable, you know, enterprise-ready great models, where in the first month of Flux models, we reached from like 2 million to 10 million in revenue. It was like a big jump. Next month, we were at 20. Like it just started going from there. And then video models started, came around. You know, we partnered with Luma Labs. We partnered with other video model companies. In China, we partnered with Kling, Kuaishou, Minimax. And with these models, like, you know, it created another market segment that was a big jump. And the final biggest thing was VO3, where it actually created this like usable text to video component, where before text to video was like a very boring, soundless video that you would not get enjoyment out. Whereas now it's like such a great experience. You can create all these like memes that you're seeing online, all these ads. So that was like another big jump for us, like partnering with Google DeepMind for VO3.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good history of generative media, yeah. And that soundbite. So I wanted to double click on that, because obviously we can dive. I think everyone's interested in video, but there's a whole history of the image side that I wanted to cover first. Just definitely wanted to start with was just the decision to pivot. I think I just want to double click on that. You know, it's not a trivial decision, but obviously the right one. Mm-hmm. At the time, I would say like a lot of people were hosting Stable Diffusion, right? So it wasn't obvious that you can just build an entire company around effectively just specializing in diffusion and inference. What gave you the confidence? What were the debates back and forth?
Yeah, a couple decisions we had to make there. We could have evolved the company into more towards GPU orchestration. And like essentially we had this Python runtime. We were running it on top of GPUs. Like that could have been the company. But we saw every single person, every single company who are using what we had, like a little SDK to run Python code on GPUs, they were doing the same thing. They were deploying a Stable Diffusion application, maybe using some LoRAs on top of it, different versions of it, inpainting, outpainting, things like that. I mean, it was very wasteful. We decided, okay, this needs to be an API where we actually optimize the inference process and everyone benefit from it. And like you can run it multi-tenant, you know, the utilization is much higher than. So that was the decision number one. And then obviously after Stable Diffusion, I think like 4 or 5 months later, Llama 2 came out and there was a decision point again.
You could do language models. Yes,
exactly.
You know?
And a lot of the inference providers at the time, there were maybe a couple of them, and they all went all in on language models. And we decided language models, hosting language models is not a good business. At the time, we thought, okay, we are going to be competing against OpenAI and Anthropic and all these labs. Turned out that it was even worse, because the killer application of language models is search, and you are competing against Google at the end, and Google can basically give this for free if they can, because it's so important for them, and you know it threatens their business right away. And with image and video models, it was a net new market. We weren't going against any incumbent. We weren't like trying to get market share from someone much bigger than us. And we liked that aspect of it. We thought we could be a leader here. It was a niche market, but it was very fast growing. So we chose to be a leader or play to be a leader in this fast growing niche market rather than trying to go against Google or OpenAI or Anthropic. So that was the decision we made. And turns out it's a good one, because we are able to define the market we are in and educate the people and grow with it. And so far, it's been growing fast enough that we were able to build a whole company around it.
Yeah. And I think you noted at AIE that, you know, now there's a generative media track.
Yeah.
And a generative media specialist.
Thank you for
investors.
Calling it generative media, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's a thing and people care about it. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's going to change the economy. And as a creative person, I think, like, I also want yeah. What's going to do for us. just so I want to keep it technical and keep thinking about the pivot, because I think it's still like one of the most interesting pivots I've seen in the AI era. You were not CUDA kernel specialist at the time, right?
I come from a compiler's background. So my job was optimizing, you know, like Python bytecode interpreter to make stuff faster, which is performance engineering. And like, yes, like I don't think at the time there was that many CUDA kernel specialists either. So it's like we were at like the right time, you know, the space was actually so, so much worse than what we have today, where like the running basic like Stable Diffusion 1.5 was like a unit with convolutions, and the convolution performance on environments was like you're getting like 30% of the GPU power if you just use RavTorch, because no one cared about it. So there was like so many low-hanging fruits that we started to pick up and started optimizing, and it kind of evolved. Right now it's like much more competitive space with like NVIDIA has like a 50% 100% kernel team that's writing kernels. You're competing against that. At the time no one really cared about it. So it was like a good new field for us to go thrive.
And there's no community effort like a VLM.
Exactly. When these models were first released, like no one in the world has ran them in production. Like it just didn't exist.
It's like a research output.
Exactly.
It was stability.
Yeah, you had your maybe local GPU. Maybe you had like a single GPU that you rented from the cloud. And basically, this was a research interest rather than a product interest. And no one at Meta, no one at Google had run this in production. So we also thought this is a good time to start a company around this and actually spend time optimizing it as much as we can, because if we can get millions of people to use this, there's a lot of economical value to be created there.
Can you talk a bit about how much of a performance boost you get? Because I know when I met you guys, you were about $1 million of revenue. You were like, well, we're writing all these custom kernels. Yeah. And maybe part of it is like, okay, how many kernels can you actually write?
Sure.
You know, as you support all these different models, like, what's kind of like the breadth of them? Like, are you writing kernels that you can reuse across models? Like, how much work do you have to do on a per model basis?
It really evolved in the past 3 years. You know, when we first started, there was a single model, Stable Diffusion 1.5. So all of our kernel efforts were, how do we make Stable Diffusion 1.5 as fast as possible? You know, you go from like 10 seconds with PyTorch. At the time, there was not even like a Torch compile, Torch inductor, or whatever. So you were going from 10 seconds to maybe like 2 seconds on the same GPU. And like we started with that. The next thing, like, you know, with adding more models, you know, like Stable Diffusion XL was a different architecture, PyXArt was a different architecture, all these like different architectures started coming around. We said, let's build an inference engine, which is what we call a collection of kernels, parallelization utilities, diffusion caching methods, quantization, all that stuff combined into one package. And so we built this inference engine. The same time PyTorch 2.0 was released with Torch Inductor and Torch Dynamo to do like Torch Compile, which is like essentially a way to trace the execution of your neural net and generate Triton kernels. There are few like that are more efficient. And I'm a big sucker for just-in-time compilers. I used to work at PyPy, like a just-in-time compiler for Python. And we said, this is a great idea. Let's apply this, but a more specialized, more vertical way for diffusion models. At the time, it was units. Now it's diffusion transformers, which are significantly different than your autoregressive transformers in terms of like the profiles of like how compute bound it is, what sort of the kernels are taking the majority of the time, you know, if you're doing bidirectional attention or causal attention. So we started doing that. And now it's like what we have today is a inference engine that's like applicable, that gets you like 70-80% of majority of the models on diffusion transformers. And we still have like a lot of custom kernels for out of models to squeeze out, like, because they're still small. Every model wants to make an architectural difference. You guys see this on like, you know, even for stuff like, you know, Qwen, DeepSeek, whatever. People want, like, even if we know an architecture is the best, they want to tweak it a little bit just to make sure, oh, we're releasing something cool. So we saw this, and then like for that, we have to write like custom kernels for custom RMS norms that people are doing or whatever, like stuff like that. So we have a decent amount of kernels, like over 100 of custom kernels. This doesn't include the auto-generated ones. You know, we have templates of kernels that generates like, you know, for thousands of different shapes, problem spaces, whatever. But like, if you consider those, you know, like we have tens of thousands of kernels, obviously at runtime that we are running and dispatching, but that's pretty much like the depth and breadth of it.
And on average, a model on FAL runs 10x faster than I would self-host it. Like, if I just take Stable Diffusion, right, and I put it...
I know, like, this might be a bigger discussion point. Do we consider speed as a mod? This comes to that. Like, the existing open source industry evolves so fast, where, you know, like, if you go to, like, this might have been true 3 years ago. Now, PyTorch is, like, already, like, very, very good for H100s, right? What about B200s? When you use PyTorch with B200s, Blackwell chips, you're not getting the best performance. So our main objective and our main goal is, for whatever GPU type you're using, these diffusion models, we're going to extract the best performance. at any point in time, it could be 1.5x, it could be 3x, it could be 5x. For certain models, it could be 10x. It would be a bit of an unfair thing to say, oh, we're going to make everything magically 10x faster. No one in the world can do that.
We are lucky that this is a moving target and open source community, everyone catches up. But at the same time, new chips come out, new architectures are released. So we are always ahead of like what's possible, but then they catch up, but we have to stay ahead of it. And that's how we can create differentiation, because it's a moving target, because there's so much going on. We are whenever something new comes up, we are the first one to optimize it, first one to adapt our inference engine to it. So at that time, the fastest place to run it, that helps with margins, things like that. But eventually, people do catch up. I think it's very hard to create this differentiation over long term if there is no new architectures, if there's no new chips. But luckily, there is all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think with image specifically, you cannot stream a response, so to speak. So when you have a language model, it's like you're kind of bound by like how quickly how you can read. So even with like Grok, it's like it's impressive to show a thousand tokens a second, but it's like I'm not reading that fast, right? So it can go slower.
Yeah.
Versus with images, it's like you just need to see it. That's why Midjourney now has like the draft mode, for example. Mm-hmm. It just gives you this like very low quality
low resolution.
Yeah. But at least you can see whether or not it's going in the right direction. How much of that is actually true for like your customers? What do they care about the most? Like, is latency that important? What's the range of latency that matters?
Yeah, latency is really important. One of our customers actually did a very extensive A-B test of like they on purposely slowed down latency on file to see how it impacts their metrics. And it had a huge part in it. And it's almost like page load time. When the page load's slower, you know, you make less money. I think Amazon famously did a very big A-B test on this. It's very similar. Like when the user asks for an image and, you know, iterating on it, if it's slower to create, they are less engaged. They create fewer number of images and things like that. Yeah.
It's the same learning that Amazon has, like every, you know, 10% improvement in speed.
Yeah, exactly.
And the elasticity is high. The other thing I wanted to also dive into, you know, like putting a little bit of the investor hat on, one of the reasons for fail success is kind of not within your control, which is how, when and how people release open models for diffusion. Mm-hmm. Which, like, at the time, it was just stability. And, like, there was no Chinese, output. I mean, what we did have other image models, but they were not great.
And so you
made a bet on when it was just, like, wasn't super obvious. But then the other thing is what you're touching on. The diffusion workload is very different from the language workload. And the language workload is being super optimized, whereas diffusion is not. So you just, like, had kind of no competition for a while, which is fantastic for you.
100%. And, like, the open source, we benefit a lot from it, obviously. But like in the past 6 months, a year, we started working with some of the closed source model developers as well, like behind the scenes helping them.
But they're not sending you their weights.
They do.
They are.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you have to give secure, like guarantee them? I mean,
we are any cloud provider. Like, yes. what do they think in like AWS or Google Cloud or these neoclouds? There's like 50 neoclouds, right? Like we are not that different from any other cloud provider. And this is why we package the inference engine in a way that, you know, they can self-serve this and get 80%, 90% of the performance. So they don't even have to show us like their code. They deploy to we have our own cloud platform where our inference engine is available only in that platform. So they can tap into that when they deploy their code and their model weights to us, and we don't really have to look at it. If they want to collaborate with us, which some companies did in the past, where we would just essentially, we have performance engineers acting as forward deployed engineers on their behalf and writing custom kernels for them.
Okay. Have you disclosed who you're doing this for?
Like, we disclosed PlayHD, PlayAI. Okay. That was one of those. We have like 4 different companies, 4 major video companies that we are doing this with, and 1 image company that I don't think we disclosed.
Yeah. As you can imagine, it's a little sensitive for them. So
I would say like sort of like Replicate started serving VO3 models, and we were like, okay, are you just wrapping their APIs or something? And I think so. It's not obvious like how much integration there is going on and how much it's on your infra or like your tech.
Just to be honest, like some of that is happening too.
Yeah,
VO3.
Yeah.
Like I think everyone
it's just
is,
API yeah, wrapper. Yes, yeah,
yes. It is. Yeah, you have a dedicated pool that you can serve to your customers with like different speed SLA guarantees, whatever. Okay. That's like how it would work for something like VO3.
But your objective is to be one-stop shop, but then also you can do inference better than some of these other, PlayHD.
Like the Google is obviously hard, but like with other vendors, like our goal is like helping them run inference because these are research labs that doesn't necessarily invest heavily on inference optimizations, scaling up infrastructure. That's like another challenge that we can talk about. Like at launch days, like some of these models, like in their website, they just like explode, and Fala API is working fine because they deployed and we can scale up to like thousands of GPUs instantly. So there's that aspect too. When we pitch this value prop, as well as a distribution that we bring to them, it's a no-brainer for them to just like deploy their model to Fall and use it for both the Fall marketplace as well as their own distribution channels.
Yeah, a couple of follow-up questions. Just on PlayHT, just because you mentioned it, music, audio, is that a different workload than normal diffusion or is that the same?
Some of, like, I can't really comment on their architecture, but like some of them are autoregressive models in the like open source world, some of them are autoregressive, some of them are diffusion-based. So, you know, there's like notorious ones that's known for diffusion, as you guys can guess, like one of the biggest companies. So it's similar workload. But at the end of the day, you know, our performance, our inference engine is like very versatile and our performance team is very versatile. With PlayHT, we had like very deep collaborations where we had like three engineers at some point, you know, helping them optimize their inference process as well as infrastructures to get them like ADMS end-to-end time to first audio chunk, which is like a very impressive thing for real-time text-to-speech workloads.
And then the other hard, known hard problem is serverless GPUs, which is a thing that everyone has chased a lot and many people have failed. What can you say about like what you've done there to make it happen? Like, so for example, Modo has been talking a lot about their GPU snapshotting, but like, I imagine it's like a stack of technologies in order to achieve the scaling.
Stack of technologies. The biggest problem with serverless GPUs is, are you just wrapping another, like if you have like a Kubernetes deployment, are you just wrapping it and giving people access? Or are you actually like multi-cloud? Do you manage your own orchestration chain? Do you manage your own container runtime? Do you manage like all this like stack? And in our case, like we started with a Kubernetes version when we were just doing it for ourselves. And Kubernetes version at Google Cloud was fine in 2022 when we wanted to get 8 A100s. But when we wanted to go to like thousands of H100s, it's not going to work. It's a terrible position to be bound by a single cloud. So right now we work with 6 cloud providers and we have 24 different data centers in 4 different countries. And we now do like long-term data center leases as well to manage like some of the hardware chain ourselves. In this world, like we had to build our own orchestration layer. We had to build our own distributed file system. We had to build our own container runtimes, all the stack to make sure that the cold starts are extremely, extremely fast, which is one of the things when you're scaling up, as well as handle actual scale where, you know, like we are managing over like 10,000 plus H100 equivalents today.
Yeah, and a CDN for caching.
CDN, that's like outside of the serverless infrastructure, but like CDN, content moderation systems, like all of these like all consists of the platform. Like there's like so many.
You also do moderation.
We also offer content moderation services to the foundation model companies for them to like moderate their inputs and outputs.
Yeah, I see. As a separate product.
Yes.
From a GPU perspective, do you always need to be on the latest? You keep mentioning H100s.
Majority of our workloads are in H100s because price perf-wise, it makes sense. But like Blackwell is obvious. Like we have 5 people dedicated to writing Blackwell kernels right now to make sure we can, like, because theoretically it looks good, right? Like flops dollar-wise, it makes sense. But can you reach that actual flops? No. So we have a dedicated team that's like working with NVIDIA directly to write custom kernels for Blackwell for diffusion transformers to get to the point where it makes perf dollar make sense. And then we would start with our own workloads as well as some of our foundation model companies. We would ask them, oh, if you want to migrate to Blackwell, here's an inference stack that already works.
We are at that point where we should be the ones pushing the boundaries on Blackwells because no one else is doing this work. And maybe it doesn't make sense economically right now, price perf wise, but we know it can. So we are like working towards maybe like a couple months away from that point. And then whenever it does, we'll probably switch as many workloads to Blackwells as possible.
Just to be super crazy, when does it make sense to just work on an ASIC?
I don't think it does. That's like honest opinion. You know, like this is like one of the most controversial topics, right? Like is all these like ASICs a great idea? If you're like SRAM, if you're memory bandwidth bound and like you can put all of SRAM, is it like even economically viable at that point? I don't know. But like the summits are around like these chip designs, you see like, okay, what is the overhead of an NVIDIA GEM instruction, right? It's like 16%. So like you're essentially buying a matrix multiplication machine. So it doesn't really make sense to specialize it that much. And like some of the like B300s are gonna have like a better softmax instruction that gets like 1.5x, whatever. And like that might be one way where NVIDIA gets like, you know, better performance out of the majority of like for the majority of workloads, which is like attention heavy stuff. I think it might make sense for like NVIDIA to like add more specialized stuff. But like for us, I don't think it will ever make sense to build ASICs.
Just thinking about from first principles that the diffusion workload is very different, but also obviously there's still a lot of changes in the architecture that you need to just need general purpose.
We don't have a single model where we are trying to optimize. We are trying to do it for the newest, the best, like always. The flexibility is therefore really important.
I was going to show, I'm going to pull up the Qwen MMDIT where there's like this dual streaming thing, which I think SD3 had it.
Yes, SD3 Flux.
Is that the standard model now?
MMDIT, so it's also a controversial topic. You know, Scaling Rectified Flow of Transformers paper, the SD3 paper came up with this architecture. And then one of our research team, actually, like Simo Rayo, he's like our head of research, he found out that like just using MMDITs are inefficient. You need to mix them. And now there's like controversial opinions, you know, like Movie Jam paper were saying, oh, MMDIT is completely unnecessary. You can just use a single stream DIT, whatever. So like there's like controversial opinions happening in terms of architecture changes, which I understand because everyone wants to do a different architecture. Like, no one wants to use the same architecture because it's lame. Otherwise, like, it's just a matter of compute and data, and these researchers don't feel proud that their model is an output of data and compute. They want to make a novel research change. So I think the architectures is going to keep changing until this like paradigm of like, you know, researchers changing stuff for the sake of changing, you know, finishes. Yeah.
I'll talk about a couple other architectural things just to keep it bounded within this topic. The distillation was a thing for a while. SDXL Lightning, you guys did fantastic demos of Tail Draw, which we've also had it on podcasts. Fantastic episode. What happened to those things? How come they're not popular anymore?
I think it makes for a good demo. You know, you could build real-time applications. You could build these drawing applications, things like that. But I don't think people could build applications that like have user retention long term. Like people couldn't really build useful things with it.
Let me play out what I thought was going to happen and then you tell me why it didn't happen.
Sure.
Which is consistency models for drafting. It's like you use your pen to draw things and, and it creates the draft. Then you upscale, right? With a real model. But like that's it. Like why can't it be a two-stage process instead of one stage?
Yeah. And I think one thing that happened is Flux, like that generation of models were not good at image to image when it first came out. So like you need a good image to image model to be able to draw. Maybe it needs to be revisited around this time with some of the editing models, maybe.
Like image to image and controllers. Flux, like SDXL era, controllers were very popular where like people were used to do this stuff, like sketch to image, whatever. Mm-hmm. And like with Flux era, I think people cared less about it. One thing that I keep thinking about this is like, is this true for LLMs too? You know, like, I always default to Claude 4.1 Opus, right? Like, even if it's slower than Sonnet, it's just like, I know I'm going to get the best quality.
And exactly.
Like,
that's what's happening here.
Yeah. That is, it seems like what's happening here as well.
As a creator, I'm like, I want fast, quick drafts and then I can refine, right? Like, so I don't know why it didn't happen.
True for video models, right? It used to be like 5 minutes, 4 minutes for a single 5 second generation. Now it's mostly under a minute, but you want 10 second, 5 second generation. And then because the workflows of like creatives when they're working with it, they generate a ton of videos and then like pick one and then create a story around it. So when you watch these people actually generate videos, they generate like hundreds at a time and they have to like kind of sit around and wait and then like iterate on it. Like the faster speeds mean a lot for creators.
Yeah, it does. The other thing I wanted to also briefly touch on before we go back to the main topics is the autoregressive models, which you mentioned, right? Like, obviously, I honestly still think Gemini is underrated because they were first. Mm-hmm. But then obviously, OpenAI did the 4.0 image gen, and that was a huge thing. I actually even wonder if there was a panic for you guys because obviously, this is Soda image gen and like no one else has it. It's not open source.
You've passed through those eras so many times. Man,
stopped worrying about it.
Yeah. Yorkiam has like good stories around Dolly.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about this how like when Dolly 2 first came out, I was like, okay, OpenAI is so far ahead of anyone else. Like it's impossible for
Midjourney.
And then people caught up within months and then Stable Diffusion was even maybe better or just as good as Dolly like a couple of months later, and it was open source. So like a year later, same thing happened with Sora. Like they put out those videos. And that time around, like I think we were excited because now that people see that it's possible, like this is like actually doable, researchers get motivated and they see the hype, they see that this is possible, so they work on it. And within a couple months we had maybe not Sora level but much better video models. Now we have video models that are much better than Sora, So whenever we see someone actually pushing the frontier, it's a reason for excitement because now that's possible. Other people are just going to do it within a couple months. So we don't panic anymore.
Is the fact that Anthropic doesn't have an image generation model tell you anything about what the larger labs care about?
It tells more about Anthropic's own like personality priorities than like the in general like what the other labs, because every like you, if you look at XAI, if you look at Meta, if you look at OpenAI, if you look at Google, they all have really good image models.
Yeah, like Google in their last announcement, they used the word generative media, by the way, which was a proud moment for us.
It's
like
a win.
And a lot. And you know, they focused on generative media as much as their new LLM models. So some labs definitely care about it, and some labs it's not a priority for them.
Look at XAI, they keep pushing like image media.
AI slop. I know it's crazy.
And waifus.
In levels of interactivity, you have images, you have video. Now you have Genie, this kind of like more world model. You have kind of like gaming applications of that. How far are we from like FAL getting a lot of traffic on those models? Like, is it mostly experimental today in open source? Obviously, Genie is impressive, but like it's a Google model, you know?
I have a very optimistic take on this, and that may be like a normal outcome. I think at worst, we are going to have very capable video models that come out of world models, right? It's going to be a very controllable video model, and the use cases will be similar to what video models are. You're going to create content, but you're able to control the camera angles. You're able to control the video model a lot better than what you can do today. At worst, we are going to get that from world models. And at best, I think it's very hard for anyone to predict what's going to happen. Yeah, movies and games, like it's going to be something in the middle where you can be part of a whole movie universe. That's going to be playable. So it's boundless possibilities. What's going to happen at best, and how affordable is it going to be? Like, is this ever going to reach mainstream adoption? We'll see all that. But it's definitely technically incredibly exciting and impressive what's coming out of these labs. Yeah.
I need to find the paper again, but there was this study on like video models and like image generation understanding physics.
Yeah.
And like, it could like predict the orbit of a planet, but then when it actually had it draw out the gravitational forces, it was like completely wrong.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think like that's my thing with world models. Like, I understand the creator application, which is how you can create a consistent world.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know if like the other side of people that are like, hey, these are like the best way to like simulate the world and like get intelligence and things like
There's
that.
So
I don't know that.
Optimism around it too, because whenever you talk to someone who's working on robotics, they're bottlenecked by the amount of data they have. And from all these, you know, past 3 years of AI innovation, we've seen that whenever there's an abundance of data, that type of models actually like improve a lot. And you see, so like robotics, we expect something similar. Whenever they figure out this data problem, those models are gonna get better as well. So that's why people are so optimistic. Okay, maybe this solves the robotics data problem. And it's, boundless opportunities there.
And regarding like the example you mentioned about gravitational forces, is like, I think this is still the same problem as, oh, LLMs can't do 9.9 plus like 9.8. You just need to train it with more data. You need to have a better tokenizer. It is the reason, whatever. It's just a matter of like data scale and like the underlying fundamental architectures. But like, I don't think it's going to change that much. We just like, we're going to put 1000x more data, 1000x more compute, and we'll get like the best physics simulators. And I think this should be possible with the existing signals coming from the data.
Just to double click on video stuff as well.
Yeah.
You had a great slide at AIE where you're like, currently 18% of FAL's revenue comes from video models, and it might be
That was February. So now it's probably over 80.
No, 50%.
50?
Yeah. Okay.
It's like over 50.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess editing models brought some life into the image as well. So like both of them grew, but video grew faster for sure.
Video is like pretty, pretty significant. And the one of the main drivers is open source models, where, you know, in February, there was Hunyuan video. I think that was like pretty good. There was Mochi from Genmo, but like the quality still wasn't there. And one from Alibaba was like insanely good model, and they released a newer version of this in like a month ago, I think, or like a couple of weeks ago, and now like it's getting so popular, and like we can run this model like for like 480p, like the draft mode version, we can run it like 5 seconds under 5 seconds, so people can have like instant feedback loop, and then when they want to go to 720p, like full resolution is just like 20 seconds, and we're planning to bring it down to 10 seconds.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I want to double click on that. Like for a while, I was kind of bearish on Alibaba because they kept releasing papers with very cherry picked.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like it was like okay, we're on GitHub, and then you go to GitHub, it's a readme. Like,
yeah. No, I mean, you can see something really change. They've been releasing new image models, new video models.
No, we haven't talked to them. But like, it seems like, and now there's like competing teams inside Alibaba. You know, one is a really good image model, but they released Quen as a competing. Quen's image model, like, you know, we think like one's image model is actually very, very good. If you do one with single frame instead of like 81 frames or whatever, you get a really good text image model out of it. And this is just because of the pure amount of data that you put from the videos. So now there's like, you know, Alibaba has like two of the really good models like from their lab. And then there's like smaller labs in China that like you might not hear about, but like StepFun, they released like an image editing model, Hydream, Vivago, yeah. like there's like all these like small labs they're releasing, because I don't think training these image or editing models are that expensive, and video models might be like slightly more expensive. My guess is like training these costs like $2 million, which is not that much, especially, you know, like, you know, they're probably backed by some sort of entity, you know, like other than Alibaba, you know, like there's like StepFun, whatever, they probably raise like a really good amount of money. So training these models will bring you a lot of attention, and it's more attention than you would get releasing a subpar LLM, because like LLM space has so much more competition. So just training this for like $1 million a video model and then releasing it, I think that brings you a lot of attention.
It is a hack. When you look at Hugging Face, let's look right now, I'm sure the top models are image models. Like it's a Quen image editing probably is
probably up there. Yeah.
Probably up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, number one.
Number one. Yeah.
Hunyan Gamecraft
is number two.
Number four.
Number four.
Then you got Gemma, $270 million.
Hit some image stuff.
ByteDance hasn't open sourced, but they have a really good team. Seed, that's their new lab. They're working on Seedream, Seedance, OmniHuman, like stuff like that. We have a good partnership going with them to hopefully, you know, have their models hosted in US as well.
Yeah.
And the idea is, you know, like, I think that the team that they were able to assemble is very good, and it's coming from, you know, their previous researchers, whatever. Like ByteDance was doing a really good open source stuff on like STX of Lightning. They released like STX of Lightning paper, Animative Lightning. So I'm pretty hopeful about them.
Yeah. First of all, you know, hopefully they don't reach out to you when they launch. They just drop and then you have to rush.
At this point, like people reach out to us because like we are the market leader, so like they just like reach out to us for like the getting distribution.
Yeah, there's a Chinese platform that they always launch on first, which I forget the name of it, but like you have to.
We also get like day zero launch with the majority of these models.
But like so basically, I think like the question is always like, you know, you are the ones making money. Stability did not make money from Stable Diffusion.
I think the thing that Black Forest Labs did was very, very interesting in this aspect. They released three different models. Apache 2 licensed, extremely distilled model, which is good for
dev.
Chanel. This is the Chanel version. This is like the for four-step generations for like lower quality stuff. They released a dev model with a non-commercial license where their inference partners are, you know, like you're paying a revenue share with like, and this is like a very good way. And then there is a pro version where you can like collaborate for hosting it. And I like the revenue share is obviously different for that as well. Yeah. This is, I think, a very smart choice for labs whose whole premise is releasing models. But if you're a company that is doing a product in the side, you don't necessarily need to make money from the open source models. You're doing it for getting researchers, you know, hiring people, getting distribution, whatever. So it really depends on like the company's goals. Like for Alibaba's case, like they don't care if one model is like hosted in their API, right? Like Alibaba makes it doesn't touch the Alibaba's top line revenue, whatever one makes. So it's like for them, it's like it's a no-brainer to release it and get attention and maybe like get some leads to their Alibaba cloud offerings. But like in general, for Black Forest Labs or companies like that, I think it's like a smart move to release like a distilled version as like fully open source and then like less distilled or like the actual model as non-commercial. And then partner with inference companies and stuff like that.
What's the distribution of usage? So like is 80% of your revenue like five models? Like, or are people really using like the long tail of all these open models outside of like the initial launch?
I think like there is some power law, but not as much as you would think. And it keeps changing. That's the other part. Like it's not like only a single model that's being used a lot. Like month to month, it changes a lot. This summer has been crazy. There've been like just countless amount of new video models, new image editing models. Like the leader kept changing week over week even. But if you like take a step back and look which models are being used. People want to use either the best, most expensive video model, or they want to use like a cost-efficient, like good but cheap enough video model. So those two models are usually like used a lot. And whatever those models are, it changes week over week. And yeah.
The one good example is like Flux Context was released, you know, like on late May, and Coen Imager that was released like 2 weeks ago, and now it's like topping out Context Dev. You know, it's insane how quickly this stuff transition just because there's a better quality model, and that's the value prop. Like you don't have to set up the infrastructure to manage Flux Context Dev. As soon as like Coen Imager Edit is available, you can just switch to that with Fall.
I mean, it seems to me that if some models are open and some models you have to pay a revenue share, you ideally want to move the people off the revenue share models into the open models, right? Like, what's that dynamic?
It's all priced in.
I'm also thinking like, okay, we'll do whatever our customers are going to be successful with. We are still like early enough that these small calculations, right, I don't think it matters. I'd rather people actually go to production and build products with it and be successful rather than like, okay, 20% here, 10% there.
I mean, you're doing $100 million in revenue. Cool.
I'll just ask a few more questions we had around just like how people really use this. Okay, I'll ask this super obvious question.
Yeah.
How much is not safe for work?
Almost none.
Negligible, yeah.
You don't moderate everything. Moderation is optional, right?
Moderation is optional to a level where like illegal content is moderated. Okay. And we also track the non-illegal content NSFW moderation. And like we haven't seen more than 1%.
Like the models themselves are actually not generating that type of content.
So some model providers, especially like, you know, if you look at Black Forest Labs models, the models are not for... It's incapable of generating because it's like, it's annealed in a way that is prevented. So, and like majority of our customer base, like if you look revenue wise, it's like enterprises or like more on like the higher level of stuff where some of them might be like user space mobile applications, but you know, like for the last 6 months, 9 months, we've been transitioning more and more to enterprise where it's like less of a need for them, like or less of a.
So what are those enterprises doing? You know, apart from like building a general purpose chatbot that can generate images, maybe Canva, you know, would be like a good use case. But my imagination is a bit limited beyond that.
Advertising seems to be absolutely like growing. And if you think about it, it fits very well. And let's talk about video advertising. So like, I keep repeating this, but some companies talk about, oh, we are going to change Hollywood. Like, filmmaking is going to be revolutionized. Like, I don't think it's that interesting. Like, how many movies do you watch a year? Like, maybe 20, 25 movies. How many movies in the theater you watch? 3, 4 at most. So if there are like thousands of movies that a year, like people won't be able to watch all of these movies. Like there's just not enough time.
It's a
like,
max quality game.
Exactly. Yeah. And with advertising, it's the exact opposite. The more content there is, the different like, you know, ways you can create ads, there is always economical value attached to it. So you can create unlimited number of ads, unlimited different versions of it. And more personalized it is, more, you know, economical value there is behind it. So with ads, it fits really well to this type of technology because there's no limit what you can create.
I'll tell you a side comment about a Silicon Valley trend I'm seeing, which I cannot explain, which is that all these YC startups and all these, they're spending between $10,000 to $70,000 per launch video.
Yeah.
In the age of generative video. Like, they're hiring, you know, actual creative directors, hiring a studio, hiring actors. I was in one of them. And like, do you need all that when you have generative video?
Like, I think Cluely Roy started talking about generative video as well.
I don't know if you guys know PJ Ace. Yes. I think he's like the absolute killer for this stuff.
He launched like is it a Super Bowl ad or something?
Basketball playoff.
Yeah. NBA Finals, right?
Yeah, NBA
Finals. He also did our like Series B announcement video. Like we're like pretty close with him. And like that, it's insane that like what he's able to come up with and how viral it goes over like, you know, these videos where you spend like hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? You know, like it's just like you just need to create viral content, and these generative media models are the best way to do it. And we're still at the infancy of this, right? Like obviously it might not be professional quality. I still think like, you know, human in the loop, like mixed, like, you know, content is the way for today. But in 6 months, who would know? Like 12 months, I think like 80% of it's going to be generated. Like we were watching Super Bowl and we were like saying, oh, how much of this video is like AI generated? It looks like AI generated. Like it could be, right?
It
like
could be.
you can't tell. So like I think at some point, you know, we're gonna have like 80-90% AI generated. All that.
It reminds me of I think who's the guy? Fofer from Replicate.
Yeah.
Obviously, he is the best inspiration for all these workflows. He like overlaid some kind of NBA realistic sort of Laura on top of game footage. So you could play like NBA 2K, but it looks like a real video.
I
was like, what the hell? It's pretty cool. Yeah, so maybe, and that's the other part of my question, and I wanted to get into Comfy UI, which is how much Laura serving is going on, right? How much custom?
A lot.
You know, okay. Yeah. Is it like majority?
That's one of the reasons.
Not majority, but like if it's like 30%, is it like the majority? You know, like,
and everyone trains their own Lauras, or you pick it off of like a Laura marketplace?
So there's like
Open source works very well with image and video models, because you tap into this big Laura ecosystem, everyone. Like, it only, like, I've never seen a closed source model that can create a good Laura ecosystem. It just basically doesn't exist. Like, maybe there is Midjourney SREFs, but I don't know if you can consider them Lauras. Maybe
SREFs are like, just seeds, right?
Conditioning, let's call it like another conditioning, okay. Like a prompt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then like only the open source models have these rich Laura ecosystems, and it's extremely, extremely popular.
But even for like the oldest models, it brings a new life, you know, like when you see these cool Lauras, we have like still a lot of people using STXL with their own Lauras because they're happy with the quality. It's fast enough, it's cheap enough, you know, like this is amazing. These models are not single shotable like the language models. You can't like even the editing models, you know, GPT image one or like Flex Context, whatever, Quen image, if you put your face, or like if you put like multiple people, whatever, you can't get the quality. Like it's going to be like 90% there. But if you train for like 1,000 steps with like 6 to 20 images, you're getting like 99% accuracy with we worked a lot on like fine tuning the right hyperparameters, like writing like distributed trainers, distributed optimizer stuff. And with those, like people can train like their Lauras under 30 seconds now on the platform, run an inference with them in the same job and get like 99% accuracy for the same face, character consistency, which is one of the biggest challenges that maybe like more on the enterprise side they're facing and less on the consumer side. You know, if you're creating AI slop, you don't really care who it looks like. But if you're actually like doing a product ad, you want it to like exactly look like the product. Every single pixel on the products, you know, banner, whatever, you want it to look like that. So you train like a LaCroix Laura with like 20 images. And then like, you know, after that, you have almost a perfect pixel perfect model.
All right, we had to train a Laura for every guest. And then we can make thumbnails with the guests doing.
Yeah.
I actually think that's a very good application because it's a nice way to inject brand, but not in a strict style.
And we are just entering like post-training on video models and what's that's going to mean, because we didn't have a good base video model that it made sense. But now we have like companies really investing into like post-training on 1.2.2 or Hunyuan, and like creating lip sync models on top of it, creating like different video effects, camera angles. Seems like there's a lot of possibilities with like creative data sets that people can do. I think in the next 6 months to a year, we are going to have a lot of like companies that are just built on post-training of open source video models.
Wow.
Let's talk about pipelines. So we are Comfy Anonymous on the podcast. Comfy UI is kind of like this community that like, if you're into it, you love it. If you don't know about it, you kind of underestimate in a way, but people create all kind of crazy workflows. One, have you thought about doing pipelines? Obviously, you host all the models. There's kind of this
question. We do have a pipeline product called File Workflows, and you can chain models together, but it's obviously less flexible than Comfy, where like you can only change like chain different models' outputs and not the intermediary stuff. In Comfy UI, you can like use like access the latents from like one model and then pass it to like a latent ops together, whatever. In our case, it's like more limited, but we have a workflows product and we have a serverless Comfy product where people can bring their own Comfy UI workflow and run it as an API with just like posting the workflow and the inputs.
And have the models be served by you.
Yes.
So is that a bullish thing? Is that going to be commoditized by big models?
The thing that we saw is, as the models get better, like Comfy UI was a much bigger thing, or like, you know, relatively much bigger thing in 2 years ago, or like a year ago, when the models were like, you know, one of the biggest Comfy UI use cases was you were like generating an ST 1.5 or STXL image, and you were fixing six finger situation, you know, like you were fixing like the resolution, you were whatever, upscaling. Now that the models are actually so good, the Comfy UI workflows are actually getting simpler for image side. For video, it's still very crazy. Like if you look at some video workflows, it's like there's like 50 nodes, whatever that you're processing. So I think this is still a matter of like how good the models are and how much extra stuff you need to do around it for majority of use cases. For artistic use cases, you still are doing like a lot of stuff, and that's like something we want to support. But like that, we don't see that happening at super scale, you know, like super scale. There's not companies that are spending like $10 million plus on running this as an API. So that doesn't seem to be happening yet. just because it's like a bit inefficient and the more existing, like it's more reliable to use an existing model than patching together 50 different things because you don't know when it's going to not work.
Yeah. But it feels like for things like ads, you want to do, you know, one step, which is like maybe generate the backdrop. One step is like adding copy. Are you saying the models are so good?
Chaining of models happening for sure. But I think ConfUI did very well is you can also play with the pieces of the model.
You're basically saying that's all.
Yeah. So like chaining of the models, like that's what the file workflow product does. It basically calls many different APIs back to back or in parallel and then creates a result at the end, I think.
And it's very popular. Yeah. Like we have like enterprise adoption from it, like from very big names.
Yeah, amazing. I was just going to go into sort of broader topics. The first thing that comes to mind was requests for startups. If you're not working on FAIL, but you see a lot of things in the ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. What's the most obvious thing that people should be working on?
More model companies. Go raise more money, train models.
That's obviously good for FAIL. Yeah.
And host them on FAIL.
We're not interested in training models, but like if other people are trained, that's amazing. Go raise more money. There's so much money.
Or like scale AI for image and video models, like data collection, like more prepared data sets for video models, like effects, different camera angles.
Yeah.
Everyone seems to be reinventing the wheel when it comes to collecting that data.
Yeah.
I think it's a great opportunity for someone to come in and do this at scale.
So it's really interesting because I think this is what Together AI did with Red Pajama, is they actually built a data set for language models to help people create more open language models that they can serve. So at some point, like actually it might make sense for you guys to do that.
The image data is a bit more finicky situation. You like the in terms of like copyright stuff, whatever, but it's an interesting area.
Do it in Japan.
I think it requires focus. It requires, like, this needs to be...
Well, one connected thing to what Görkem said is image/video RL. That's an unknown for us.
Say more.
I can't. it's like, what does it look like? Can you RL a video model to be a world model? You can, right? Like, if you consider it, like, it's essentially the world models are an RL video models where you condition it for, like, you know, moving around. So what are the use cases for RLing image and video models? I don't know. But that's, like, if I wasn't working at FAIL, that would be something that, like, that might be fun to explore.
Yeah. And is this specifically for editing? Because the RL is for, the reward is the edit, or?
That's the thing. That's what you should look for, right? Like, what is the reward function? What is the interesting reward functions that you can apply on top of these base models?
I see. Interesting. Okay, got it. Actually, I was really asking about like if I were to build a FAIL wrapper startup, like on top of FAIL. You guys are very low level, which is fantastic. you know, but I also want to give our listeners some ideas, you know, if they're not going to work at that level.
I think I'm going to say it again, advertising. Like, there's so much opportunity there and everyone's like still trying to create these horizontal applications where like any creative can come in and do something, but like a lot more targeted to specific industries, a lot more targeted to like different kinds of like ad networks. There's a lot of potential there.
Good. And then requests for models. Obviously, you want more open models. That's good for you. But like any like specialization in the models, like I think image editing was a huge unlock, which I didn't foresee until this year.
Yeah,
where we're like, obviously we're going to
Even OpenAI didn't like guess it was going to go this big. It's like it's insane, like how popular it became. And then like everyone started like catching up.
I was part of a group at NeurIPS that we meet at NeurIPS every year. And like they were talking about this at the last NeurIPS. And so like it's in the air, but you have to be at the researcher level.
And like everyone moved to video, left image behind a little bit. So there was like a little vacuum of research on image. But luckily people saw it, that it works very well. And then they went back to it.
It's so much cheaper to train image models. Like right now, like if you want to train a SOTA image model, I don't think it's going to cost more than $1 million. It's extremely cheap. It's like a matter of data engineering effort, cleaning. Like, I think it's a function of data set. Like image models are really, really, really affected by the data set that you use.
Yeah. I think one obvious thing that there's a gap in the market is like VO3 is very expensive.
Sound.
And the reason why people like it is conversation, right? If you can create maybe a smaller, cheaper video model that is less capable, but can do conversation and sound very well, I think there is definitely
one open source one that we saw was Multitalk. It was a post-trained version of one, and it's like really, really good for conversations, but it lost the ability to generalize. You know, it's only like talking faces at some point versus like VO3, it could generalize and it could do scenes and whatever. Yeah. So I think that there needs to be like some middle ground between these two, between talking faces and like, you know, extremely generalized video models where it's like much cheaper to run, But at the same time, you know, you get like this conversation because it's very memetic. You know, people, there's infinite amount of memes that you can post with this, infinite amount of ads that you can do with this.
But you don't see a world in which you have a video model and then you have a separate, maybe audio-only model that can generate the audio for
this is the workflows question, right?
Yeah. Like,
do you stitch together a whole bunch of things or do you bit or less?
People did that before VO3, but what VO3 gets very well is like the timing. You ask for a joke and, you know, the delivery and the timing and the laugh and, like, you know, waiting right before like the joke drops, like all of that is so perfectly timed. I don't think when you do it separately, you get it.
It also matches the human accent sound to the face that is talking, right? It's like it's an unknown challenge for like other text-to-speech models. Like it feels very natural.
Is VO3 the best text-to-speech model?
It is also one of the best text-to-speech models. It is so good. Like, I don't think any model can do what it is doing emotionally.
But I would say the counter argument is that we dub movies. So there's already, obviously you can.
It is also the best lip sync model. Like VO3 has the best, most accurate lip sync because it's generating very natively. There's really good lip sync models. I think they're like 95% there, but VO3 is like 100% there, like 99%.
Yeah. To me, this is like the single most bearish thing about workflows, right? And Comfy UI and all this stuff, like, because just wait for a bigger model. Yeah. Like, it's just pure bitter lesson. Like,
yeah, we love Comfy UI.
but I mean, obviously, like, when the technology doesn't exist yet, you have to stitch together things. Yeah. So, a request for engineers?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you're hiring, right? You just raised $125 million.
Hiring. Like, we just recently crossed 40 people, but like for like 3 months ago, we were at like 20. Yeah. So, like, for the last 3 months, we have been actually accelerating, you know, best kernel engineers, best infrastructure engineers, best product engineers, best ML engineers. If you're the best at what you do, just come join us. I think it doesn't really matter what you do. Just like, we're just hiring the best talent right now.
Even on the go-to-market side, we are hiring account executives, customer success managers, because we work with very large enterprises. We got to grow that side of the company as well.
Yeah. On the engineering side specifically, how do you think about how many people you need? There's this whole question of like lean AI, it's like, you know, coding
agent. Our performance team is like 7 people. I think 7 people like focusing on performance. Obviously, like there's some overlap with our applied ML team, which is taking these models, productionizing them, exposing new capabilities, building fine tuners. So it's like and then helping customers adapt these models. So that team, I think we can scale to like double, triple the amount because like there's infinite amount of models. And like, you know, it's better because like we're going to have more customers with more proprietary models. So just like helping them optimize it, it's just like a really good function that we have.
That team scales very well because there's always like independent work that can be done. Oh, okay. So these 3 people are working on this new model, trying to optimize that. And it's completely independent from trying to optimize this other model. So we've been hiring a lot for that applied ML team.
Our infra team, you know, we're probably going to keep it lean in contrast to the applied ML team and the product team. Maybe like we want to build more higher level components where people can directly integrate to their applications because like that's even like now. SDKs, but think about it with components. Like imagine you're an e-commerce website designer and you're not really like the best like component designer. So here's a virtual try-on component that you can put to your app. Stuff like that, more higher level components. And this is like also coming from the fact that, you know, vibe coding has been very, very insane. We see like significant, like revenue-wise, it's like very small, but like we see a significant amount of user adoption just coming from people who are vibe, like just from looking at our support tickets. Maybe they're like they need more support, but like there's like a lot of people who are like coding these applications without like that much expertise in the product building. So we want to provide them more guardrail experiences where they can integrate much easier without like messing with like all the other like lower level components.
That's really nice care of developer experience.
So crack low-level engineers.
And crack high-level.
Well, yeah, crack go-to-market people, crack whatever, just join
Paul. I'm always trying to refine the definition of crack, you know, like both of you, like you leave the technical side of L. Like what's a really hard technical problem that if someone has the solution, they should talk to you immediately? Maybe that's the way to frame it.
Write a sparse attention kernel with FP8 on Blackwell and tell, you know, like if you can do that, come join us. We already have like a good base. Hired on the spot, you know, like stuff like that. I really like picking like all these, like some of these applied ML people, like we just picked them from Discords who are working on these sort of generative media who are like already interested. We really have a high culture bar too, where everyone in the team loves generative media. Like they're obsessed with it. They would have done this if this wasn't their job. We have this great composition. We're always, it's not like a prerequisite, but it's just naturally happened where we hired these people from like Discord, Twitters, Hugging Face. Like one of our Applied ML engineers is like, had the number one top Hugging Face space with like, you know, creative workflows, whatever. So we hired a person who was training Loras on Fall, like just because they were training and posting cool Loras, you know, like just do cool stuff and we'll find you, or like you can reach out to us.
That's the master builder is what I've been calling this person.
Why not make it more explicit? So if I go on your careers website, right? It's like Applied ML Engineer. It just kind of looks like any job description. I feel like there's like this question of like...
It does.
That's why we have to do a podcast.
But I think it's not just about FAL. I think in general...
It is more like, if you know, you know, which I know is not the best way. You know, people know about FAL already. So it's like, we haven't really cared that much, but you're absolutely right. Like, we should make it more explicit.
If I look at like George Hotz, like on TinyGrad, you have these bounties. If like, hey, we'll just, if you can solve this, you should probably work here. Like, do you see?
I'm adding the bounty.
Right.
Today.
It's like, this seems like, hey, look, if you can write this kernel, it's like, you'll just get hired.
It is also, but like one thing that we saw, even with like, there's a lot of people who are just like vibe coding stuff and reviewing those. Like, there's a limited amount of people who can review those, right? Like, so like, how can you tell it's like not a shitty kernel versus like a good kernel?
Well, but then you're spending the time interviewing too,
right? Yeah. So it's like we have like first line of defense with our recruiters, whatever. So only get like, so there's like trade-offs, but I absolutely agree. Like, maybe we should have like a kernel bench version that you can upload your kernel, automatically evaluate the stability, performance, whatever, and then if you do, you get our email unlocked, whatever. A special email for you. But yeah, great ideas. Come join us. Build this.
Awesome, guys. Anything else? Parting thoughts?
Yeah, I love your rant. So
this was great. Yeah.
I'm happy to rant.
But one is the podcast star.
Yeah.
No, congrats on all your success. I should also say it's fun to do karaoke with you guys.
Yes. Just,
like you're
let's do it again.
Both extremely technical, but also like a fun crew that like, and I think it's pretty hard to and rare to see. So
thank you.
Nice to see the good guys win.
Awesome, guys.
Awesome.